The following Burl Report podcast is made possible through support from Biotech 2012, Innovating in the New Austerity, Burl & Company's 26th annual report on the life sciences industry, available now by clicking the ad on this page or going to burlandco.com.
I'm Daniel Levine, and this is the Burl Report.
Like it or not, aging is a byproduct of the daily activity of life. But Aubrey de Grey believes that the molecular and cellular damage that defines aging and creates disability and disease can be targeted for medical interventions that restore healthfulness and consequently radically extend life. We spoke to de Grey, Chief Scientific Officer and founder of the SENS Research Foundation, about the need to think differently about aging, how a new era of regenerative medicine might slow or reverse its effects, and why it's necessary to focus on medical interventions rather than prevention to have a significant impact.
Aubrey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with aging itself. I think the common view of aging is that it's a process that's natural and inevitable, that as long as you live long enough, everyone's going to go through it. What's wrong with that view?
Well, really, there's nothing wrong with that view. It's just that people forget that what's natural is not actually necessarily the same as what's good. The whole of technology is about altering what's natural and manipulating nature so as to improve our quality of life, or for that matter, our quantity of life. In particular, all of medicine is about manipulating things that are natural, like infectious diseases. And the diseases and disabilities that currently accompany old age are no different.
So should we be thinking of aging as a disease?
Well, it's a little dangerous to think of aging precisely as a disease. But what we certainly can think of aging as is the set of precursors of the various diseases of old age. So there are a whole bunch of different types of damage that accumulate in the body throughout life as just side effects of the body's normal operation. And those types of damage at the molecular and cellular level are completely harmless for a long time because the body is set up to handle them. But eventually they become too abundant for the body to handle, and that's when the diseases and disabilities emerge. So we have a bunch of different things that are called aging, the processes of damage accumulation, and they cause a bunch of different things, the diseases and disabilities of old age. So there's a sort of many-to-many relationship there, but that still means that aging is something that is a legitimate and desirable target for medical intervention.
So if we're going to medically attack aging, can we approach it the same way we would any other disease or any disease?
Not exactly. What we do at the moment for the diseases and disabilities of old age is we attack them very much as we would attack an infectious disease or something. You know, we characterize the symptoms and we try and bang away and eliminate those symptoms from the body. And that basically doesn't work because the diseases and disabilities of old age are side effects of the body's normal operation. And as the damage that causes those diseases continues to accumulate, so the job of combating the disease becomes progressively harder. What we can do is something that you might call preventative geriatrics, preventative medicine for the diseases of old age. And that means going after the damage that accumulates throughout life, the actual precursors of the diseases. There are two essential ways of doing that. One of them, which sounds quite promising and which has traditionally been pursued by a bunch of people, is to try to slow down the accumulation of damage, you know, to sort of clean up our metabolism so that it doesn't actually develop this damage so rapidly. But no one's really got very far with that because ultimately we don't understand the body well enough. The approach that I and SENS Research Foundation are taking is somewhat different. It says let's let the damage happen and be created, but then let's go in and repair it periodically before it gets to the pathogenic level of abundance.
And this is what you've described as your eureka moment, rather than crack this complex, not entirely understood metabolic process tied to aging. you say the answer can be found in focusing on this underlying damage. What's the argument for this approach, and have researchers been going about addressing aging in the wrong way?
I believe that researchers have indeed been going about addressing aging in the wrong way. They've been trying to slow down the accumulation of damage by trying to exploit what we see in the laboratory with the aging of model organisms like rats or mice. There are various things that we can do there that, on the face of it, look quite impressive, but there are good reasons to believe that they won't actually translate very effectively to human beings. Conversely, the other approach that I'm talking about, this damage repair approach, has been very neglected. It hasn't really been appreciated how much potential that approach has. Essentially, people have made the presumption that effectively reversing aging, which is what repairing this damage would be, must be harder than just slowing aging down. But that seems not to be the case.
So what is aging? Why do we grow old? What actually takes place during aging at the cellular and molecular level?
Aging is really not a mystery at all. It's no surprise that the human body accumulates damage as a side effect of its normal operation, because that's exactly what any simple man-made machine also does. And of course, the human body is a machine, albeit a really, really complicated one. What I tend to do when I try to describe the damage that accumulates during life is I classify the various types of damage into 7 major subcategories, categories that are either cellular or molecular. There are 3 cellular categories. You can have loss of cells, cells progressively dying and not being replaced. You can have too many cells because they're dividing when they're not supposed to. You can have too many cells because they're not dying when they are supposed to. Then at the molecular level, there are 2 things that happen inside the cell. One is the accumulation of mutations in the mitochondria, and the other is the accumulation of simple molecular garbage, byproducts of metabolism that the body doesn't destroy or excrete. The final 2 types of damage are outside the cell, in the spaces between cells. One of them is, again, molecular garbage, stuff that accumulates because the body hasn't got the machinery to get rid of it. And the final one is stiffening of the extracellular matrix, this lattice of proteins that keeps our tissues in the shape that they're supposed to have and which needs to be elastic in order to do that job.
So how close are we to actually reversing or repairing damage in those 7 areas?
Some of them are a lot closer than others. The penultimate one that I just mentioned, the molecular garbage outside the cell, is probably the one that's closest to fruition. It's actually been through clinical trials in the case of one example, namely the amyloid that accumulates in Alzheimer's disease. And those clinical trials got as far as phase 3. They didn't succeed in phase 3, but we have to be very careful to understand that the thing they didn't succeed in was actually treating Alzheimer's disease. And that doesn't mean that the therapy didn't work. It just means that on its own, it can't fully address this very complicated disease, Alzheimer's disease, and we need other therapies as well. What the therapy did do was effectively remove the molecular garbage, which is what it was designed to do. So, another one quite far along is stem cell therapy. Stem cell therapies in general are for replacing cells that the body is not replacing on its own. That's the first of the 7 categories I mentioned. And there are also various clinical trials going on for various types of stem cell therapy.
So there's been a fair bit of research on the benefits of diet and exercise. I know you've talked about caloric restriction a bit, the effects that can have on longevity. What's wrong with focusing on these areas? Why won't this take us where we need to go by itself?
Well, there are a couple of things that we can say about calorie restriction. This is a phenomenon that was discovered back in the 1930s, in fact, that if you feed mice or rats a fair bit less than they would like, then they live a fair bit longer than they otherwise would. However, there are good evolutionary reasons to expect that the effect of calorie restriction will actually be much less in longer-lived organisms than in short-lived organisms, essentially because famines in the wild that actually happen and actually have molded our genetic makeup are simply have a frequency dependent on the length of the famine. Long famines are not so frequent as short famines. Moreover, the data that we can see shows also that short-lived organisms tend to be able to do more in response to famine than long-lived organisms. And indeed, quite recently, it was it was announced that a 25-year-long study of calorie restriction in monkeys had come out negative. It hadn't actually shown any increase in longevity as a result of the calorie restriction. Another thing that's really miserable about calorie restriction is that it's something that it's what I was talking about, the approach of slowing down the accumulation of damage rather than repairing it, mm-hmm. which means that unless you start it really early in life, you wouldn't expect to have much of an effect anyway. If you start calorie restriction in mice at weaning, then you might get 30 or 40% of the additional life. But if you start in middle age, you'll be lucky if you get 10%. So again, it's something that those of us who are already in middle age can't really look forward to getting much benefit from. And the final thing that I have to say is that the drugs that have been in the news so much over the past few years that are being developed to try to trick the body into thinking that it's on calorie restriction when it isn't, nobody thinks that any drugs like that will ever be able to do more than bona fide calorie restriction can.
So you've said that repair is preferable to prevention. Is that why?
That's basically why, yes. Repair allows us to gain a lot more extra life than simply slowing down the accumulation of damage could possibly do, especially for people who have already reached middle age.
Well, we've certainly seen great gains in life expectancy in the past century. Part of that has come from improvements at addressing things such as infant mortality, but we do actually see people living longer as well. How much progress would you say we've seen, and what do you think accounts for that?
Right. So that's a very interesting question, and the answer is not simple. Until about World War II, pretty much all of the gains that were seen in life expectancy over the previous century or so, which were big gains, perhaps 30 or so years or more, were as a result of reductions in infant mortality, improvements in hygiene, and, of course, various medicines, antibiotics, vaccines, and so on, so that the proportion of infants who reached the who didn't reach the age of one went down from about 40%, which is what it was in the middle of the 19th century, down to only a few percent. And that, of course, causes a big increase in life expectancy. But since World War II, that's been pretty much over, and we've still seen, as you say, a continued increase, albeit at a slower rate than we were seeing before then. And this seems to be because of early life effects on people's health throughout their life, in particular things like prenatal nutrition that simply allow babies to be born with less damage in their bodies. They're born younger than they used to be. And that allows them to stave off the diseases and disabilities of old age for a bit longer than before. Now, the problem is that that phenomenon of increasing health and prosperity and associated lifestyle during early life is also, at this point, reaching diminishing returns. People who have reached 70 or 80 now were typically, in the Western world, born and raised in an environment in which nutrition was fairly reasonable. So there may not be very much more to gain there, and I'm rather expecting that over the next 10 or 20 years we won't see as rapid an increase in life expectancy as we've seen over the past few decades.
Well,
medicine to change that.
Is there a reason to believe there's a maximum as to how long humans can live? Is there something to suggest that there's a built-in maximum?
There's plenty to suggest that there's a built-in maximum of how long humans can live in the absence of medicine. The accumulation of damage in the body is an intrinsic, non-negotiable side effect of being alive in the first place. You know, the things that are really damaging, that cause this damage to accumulate, are things like breathing and, you know, metabolism of sugar, which are absolutely things that we have to do. And therefore, yes, however well you're built, however perfectly your metabolism is set up, there is going to be some minimum rate and therefore some maximum lifespan that you can reach. But the qualification in the absence of medicine is critical. If we can develop medicine that repairs this damage that's accumulating, then the sky's the limit.
So your claims about the potential to extend life often get a lot of attention, but it seems to me that the message is much less about radical life extensions than about extending healthfulness, which then leads to the side effect of life extension, as it were. Is that correct? Is the ultimate focus on healthfulness?
That is absolutely correct, and thank you for saying it. I normally have to bash interviewers over the head with that fact, and then actually mentioning it for me. So you're absolutely right. I don't work on longevity, much so most of the media tend to focus on that and sensationalize it. The fact is, I work on health, and any longevity benefits that there might be from success in the work that I do and the Prince Research Foundation does will be, as you say, a side effect of keeping people healthy. It just so happens that the particular approach that we're taking to postponing the ill health of old age has a high probability of delivering a very dramatic increase in longevity as compared to the alternative approaches that people have looked at in the past, but that doesn't make it any less of a side effect.
So, for the record, how radical a side effect are we talking about, and what do you think it'll take to get there?
Well, I think we've got a pretty good chance of eliminating aging as a significant cause of death within the next 20 or 30 years. Of course, that's a long time frame. It's very speculative. It could take 100 years. But I think we've got a 50-50 chance of getting there within 25 years or so, so long as the proof of concept research that's being done right now is well enough funded so that it moves at a reasonable pace. I think at the moment, there's a lot to be done. It could be going maybe three times faster than it actually is, simply because of lack of funding. But we're still moving forward.
So, you actually started out in the field of artificial intelligence, is that correct?
That is correct.
So how did you end up in gerontologist?
Well, I met and married a biologist back in 1990, and over the next few years, not only did I learn a bunch of biology, I also discovered gradually, and to my absolute horror, that hardly any biologists were very interested in aging, and the ones that were hardly ever working on doing anything about aging. So I decided eventually that this was an even more important problem than the problem of creating machines to do all the tedious stuff that we don't want to do. And that's the seal.
So this led you to be a founder of the SENS Research Foundation. What is the SENS Research Foundation? What role do you see that playing in getting to addressing these issues of aging?
The SENS Research Foundation is a public charity, a 501c3, based in Mountain View, California. And we have a budget at the moment of about $4 million a year, which, of course, we are seeking to greatly increase over the next couple of years. What we do with that money, predominantly, is research. We have a lab, about 3,000 square feet, in Mountain View, where three of our major projects are performed. And we also fund research in universities around the country and a couple of projects abroad. And so, essentially, what we're doing is trying to implement the whole of the SENS research program. Some of the components of SENS are deprioritized by us because they are being done quite effectively by other people. But most of these projects are highly ambitious and are simply neglected by those who have more short-term goals, like getting their next grant application funded or making a profit on some drug next year. We take a longer view, and that means that we work on things that are absolutely necessary for the defeat of aging, but which are not being adequately pursued by other people.
Well, it seems to me that one of the major barriers you've been focused on overcoming is perception itself, changing the way people think about aging and about the need to change that perspective if we're really going to make the type of investment in research in this area and the right kinds of investment in this area. What role does perception play in all this?
Perception plays an enormously important role. You're absolutely right. And that's really why I spend so much of my time doing media interviews and lectures, just educating the public about what aging really is. This is something that has somehow become entrenched in people's psyche over the millennia as the idea that aging is somehow distinct from the diseases of old age, as opposed to the true conception, which is that aging is simply the set of precursors of the diseases and disabilities of age, as I was saying earlier. So, absolutely, it's very, very important to get people to have a realistic understanding of what aging is, and then they can see that it's crazy to have any kind of ambivalence about defeating aging with medicine.
So, I think it's fair to say you're rather optimistic about this. What have you seen in the past few years that particularly drives your optimism?
Well, of course, when people say that I'm optimistic, what they tend to mean is that I'm over-optimistic, and I don't agree that I'm over-optimistic at all. I think that the reason I'm more optimistic than a lot of my colleagues is simply because I see all the work that's going on. So I could go into details of a lot of different work that's happening that's relevant. Some of the work over the past year or two has actually been a bit more overt, and even a lot of the skeptics are beginning to sit up and take notice of the idea that this damage repair approach might work. For example, there was a very highly publicized study from the Mayo Clinic a year or two ago showing that if you remove a type of cell that is accumulating to a pathogenic level because they're not dying when they're supposed to, that was the third of my seven categories that I mentioned earlier. If you can remove these cells, then there's a very great benefit in terms of the rejuvenation of the mice in question. We ourselves at Sense Foundation made a major breakthrough a few months ago, showing that we could protect cells, human cells, in cell culture from the major toxin that causes cardiovascular disease. And we would give this protection by inserting a bacterial gene into these cells. This is an idea that I put forward more than a decade ago, and we're finally making it work. And I believe that we'll be able to do the same thing in mouse models within a year or so, at which point I think everyone's going to realize that we've got a big handle on cardiovascular disease, which is, of course, the number one killer in the Western world.
Aubrey de Grey, Chief Scientific Officer and founder of the SENS Research Foundation. Aubrey, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And a reminder to our listeners that Biotech 2012, Innovating in the New Austerity, Burl & Company's 26th annual report on the life sciences industry, is now available. You can purchase the book or download a free chapter by clicking on the ad on this podcast page or going to burlandco.com. That's burlandco.com. Thanks for listening. For information on Burl & Company conferences and publications, go to burlandco.com. That's burlandco.com. And be sure to join us at burlreport.com for daily coverage of the life sciences industry. And sign up for our free e-newsletter, the Burl Weekly Brief, by hitting the sign-in link at the top of our website.